From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 9th when a specimen was taken from a patient infected with COVID in Botswana. Genomic analysis revealed that this was a new variant, first dubbed by its scientific name, B11529. It has come to be known as the Omicron variant. It's not clear where exactly it originated. The best guess initially was that it popped up in late September or early October, and there's even debate about whether it was from the African continent somewhere or even the Netherlands. From a first initial case, though, it's become a fast-spreading and potentially dominant variant. And let me stress that there is a lot we don't know about Omicron. Maybe you say Omicron, there's some debate there, but whatever we call it, it appears to be as transmissible or more than Delta. Early analysis indicates that symptoms might be a little bit different, a little more centered on fatigue, but we're still learning. There's no indication yet that it is significantly more deadly than Delta. Scientists expect that Omicron will be a little more evasive to our vaccines, but no one thinks this variant is going to set us back to the beginning. By now, we know that COVID variants move quickly, and travel bans or restrictions are not really effective. Despite what you heard in political campaigns, travel bans did not stop COVID in any meaningful way last year. By June of 2020, the United States was itself a COVID hotspot, and yet we still had travel bans in place against some other nations. You might be wondering whether we've learned anything during this pandemic. Well, how about this? Omicron has been detected in the UK, Belgium, Italy, Germany, Hong Kong, Israel, Australia, and of course, parts of Africa, South Africa especially. South Africa did the genomic sequencing and shared its data immediately. But President Biden and his team have instituted travel restrictions on 8 countries. They're all in Africa. And by the way, the Biden administration announced the planned restrictions late last week, but waited until Monday of this week to put them in place. I don't know if they hoped the virus would take the weekend off or what the deal was with that. Here's the travel restriction list per NPR. Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. A new book looks at the history of pandemics and our efforts to rein them in or deal with them. Charles Kenny is a senior fellow and director of technology and development at the Center for Global Development, and his book is called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Kenny writes, quote, COVID-19 is a terrible reminder that our victory against infection is far from complete, and in all likelihood never will be complete. The cycle of population growth, pandemic, and recovery isn't nearly as violent as it has been in the past, but it's still with us. Many more infectious diseases have emerged over the past century than have been eradicated, and the coronavirus has demonstrated the immense costs we bear when people are forced to rely on one of the very earliest responses to infection, running from it, end quote. So how can we learn from the past, both long ago and just the past 2 years? Where do we go from here? Our guests this hour include Charles Kenny, author of the book I just mentioned, The Plague Cycle, and a senior fellow and director of technology and development at the Center for Global Development. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
And Todd Moss is former Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, a Rochester native himself. Todd, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Great to be with you, Evan.
Let me just start with you, Todd. We've talked a little bit about maybe the lack of understanding of geopolitics, and frankly, most Americans don't know a whole lot about Africa in general. And here we are with eight travel restrictions. I don't see the Netherlands on the list. I don't see the UK. I don't see Hong Kong. Any surprise in your mind about these travel restrictions and maybe some general first thoughts there, Todd?
Yeah, well, look, it's frankly very disappointing. You know, most of the African countries that are on the travel ban don't actually have any reported cases of Omicron. And the irony is that we seem to be punishing South Africa, which actually did exactly the right thing, which was to raise the alarm and to be very open about sharing the data so that the world can respond as quickly as possible. And I'm extremely worried about the long-term effects of how we're treating South Africa. And I think, you know, what you're hinting at in your intro is that we now have cases, we have actual documented cases in Belgium, Britain, Canada, Germany, Israel, Italy. There's no ban on any of these countries. What is going on here? And it's actually some pretty shameful politics.
Yeah, I have to observe that if this were the Trump administration putting a ban in place on only African nations, when we know what we know about Omicron, I suspect there are many progressive voters who would have some very, very harsh criticism of it. And I can't quite get my head around why it's going this way. But I guess, Todd, one of the things we should talk about this hour is what happens to policy when politics sort of dominates here. It's just that in this case, I don't know what the political advantage is to this. Can you see one?
Yeah, so look, you know, Charles and I are both policy wonks, you know, and we sometimes find that politics gets in the way of good policy. But of course, all policies are determined by politics, and that's because politicians are making the call. What I suspect is going on here is that the administration wanted to show that they were doing something. I suspect they were quite frightened by what they learned from Omicron. And the political cost of imposing a travel ban on South Africa and several of its neighbors is quite low. They think they can manage that. And it looks like they're taking an active role to protect people, whereas if they had done that with the Europeans, there would have been a massive amount of blowback. So I think it's a kind of raw political calculation, one I'm not particularly proud of, but one that I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, and let's listen to a little bit of what President Biden had to say about this. This is thanks to the USA Today Network. Let's listen.
We're going to be cautious, make sure there's no travel to and from South Africa and six other countries in that region, and except for American citizens who are able to come back. We don't know a lot about the variant, except that it is a great concern. It seems to spread rapidly, and I spent about a half hour this morning with my COVID team led by Dr. Fauci, and so that was the decision we made.
That's President Biden explaining the travel restrictions. Charles, I don't want to be cynical about this, but I take Todd's point here, and it almost feels like policy is made in the context of, well, can you envision a political ad in a couple of years saying, how come the Biden administration did nothing when they learned about Omicron? Why didn't they shut down travel? As opposed to saying, does it even work? Is it even effective? I don't want to be a cynic, but is that a realistic concern that we should have, Charles?
I guess so. I think, you know, certainly the last election we saw President Trump being hammered, I think quite correctly, for his response to COVID-19. You know, one bright spot, I will say, was the Operation Warp Speed that, you know, did help get us vaccines very fast. But most of the rest of the policies introduced by the administration turned out to be, you know, fairly useless or positively counterproductive. And so, you know, It's fair that the administration, Biden administration, would be, you know, concerned about the same thing. But this definitely is a response that smacks more of getting some political cover than actually introducing a policy that anybody really thinks would help. Now, you know, Israel and Japan said in a response to Omicron, we're shutting the borders to everybody right now. They've actually both, as it turned out, got cases already, but that's the kind of strategy that you need to introduce if in the modern world you really want to have a travel ban with impact. As you've mentioned, you know, as of today, we think there are 19 countries that have cases. Dutch scientists are now reporting that they found it in the Netherlands, you know, before it was detected in South Africa, in fact. So, you know, this thing has already spread fairly widely. It may be too late, but, you know, the only thing that works at this point, the only thing that works with an infection as that can spread as fast as COVID-19 is a sort of complete shutdown of travel, which is not something you can sustain for very long and not something that, you know, is going to work everywhere anyway. It works in smaller countries that are less connected. It, you know, worked really quite well last year in New Zealand, for example, where they imposed a travel ban when there were only 20 to 28 cases in the country, and they, you know, kept it out. But, you know, for the United States, as connected and as big as it is, that's probably not a plausible strategy. And that's a total travel ban. you know, these partial travel bans of a few countries introduced a bit late, except for American citizens, as if, you know, American citizens couldn't catch it. Those are just political theater.
Political theater, I think, at best here. And I'm going to quote from your book a number of times this hour, your outstanding book, Charles. You write about this issue that border closures might have had a role in the past. And yes, as you note, I mean, if you've got a geographical advantage like New Zealand, perhaps, and you want to impose a full ban, perhaps. But generally, it doesn't work in today's world. You write, quote, exclusion at the border is far more expensive and far less effective in a world based on global exchange. Quarantines and border controls probably helped reduce the spread of plague, but they proved considerably less useful against cholera and yellow fever in the 19th century. Today, even while isolation of the individual sick tourist can be a practical emergency strategy, and short-term travel bans may sometimes have a role to buy extra time to respond to a new pandemic, the world is simply too connected for even the greatest build-a-wall fantasist to think that diseases can be long kept out by closing borders. End quote. And so if I could ask both of you, starting with Charles, to tell us a little bit more about what you think the costs are here. When the Biden administration or when the UK or whoever decides, okay, we heard about Omicron, let's do a travel ban, we'll target African nations. What are the costs as you see them beyond just the fact that it's ineffective, Charles?
In the short term, the costs are come in mounting an effective response. So, for example, at the moment, South Africa is struggling to get the equipment and supplies they need in order to do more testing, in order to keep up their COVID response, because all the flights have suddenly stopped. So in the short term, these bans make responding to the problem harder. I think in the long term, they have, you know, perhaps even more insidious effects. They hang around. These travel bans don't tend to come with an expiration date. Indeed, you know, if we look at cases like the travel ban on people with HIV in the United States, it lasted, you know, a decade and a half before it was finally got rid of when it was realized, you know, how pointless and how counterproductive it was. So these bans last a long time, and while they last, they reduce our ability to gain from global cooperation, which is the very thing that is helping us with this disease. Just to take, you know, a sort of personal story, when I got my first shot of the Pfizer vaccine, you know, what, 9 months ago or so, it was shot into my arm by a woman who was born in Vietnam. The vaccine itself was created by components from a bunch of different countries using research that was a bunch of two kids of Turkish immigrants living in Germany, created by a company run by a Canadian living in the United States. You know, this was a global effort to put together this vaccine and get it in my arm. And the more that, you know, travel bans reduce our ability to cooperate across borders, the more they'll have an effect on our ability to respond to disease, but also just, you know, our global quality of life.
It was Charles's book that I was referencing when I mentioned that the United States travel ban in 2020, we had a travel ban that existed well into the summer. And, you know, we were a global hotspot by then. If anything, maybe people wanted to ban travel from the United States. So you could see just how silly some of this stuff is. But Charles also points out in his book that there have been other recent epidemics or pandemics in which travel bans were attempted. He writes, quote, travel controls put in place over the H1N1 virus led to a 40% drop in air traffic to and from Mexico following the international alert, but had no effect on the spread of the disease. Epidemiologist Paolo Bajardi and his colleagues argue that the evidence from the H1N1 outbreak suggests that even a comprehensive travel ban would, at best, have delayed the spread of the condition by 20 days. End quote. So, yeah, there's just so little to be gained in the modern world unless you absolutely stop travel. And Todd, how do you see the costs beyond just an ineffective response?
Yeah, so, you know, maybe we hope to gain a delay of a week, or maybe if we're really lucky, 2 weeks delay. That's what we're buying with the travel ban. But the long-term impact is what's really worrying. So how are we going to defeat this virus ultimately? It has to be through global cooperation and especially through maximum information sharing. And travel bans work against all of this. It just creates huge disincentives to share information. If you know that your country makes a discovery, but if you reveal that to the world, you're about to be hit with a travel ban that could tank your economy, especially while you're trying to recover and create jobs. If you know you're going to put millions of people out of work, why would you share that information? You wouldn't. You would keep it secret. And South Africa, a lot of other countries are looking at the treatment of South Africa right now and, you know, wondering, you know, are we next? And if this happens to us, how would we respond? And I just think that it just bodes very, very poorly for Charles' point, which is that this is only going to work through open discussion, open information, and through global cooperation. And this really just sets us back.
Well, speaking of global cooperation, the concern going well over a year now among many critics, and critics in the medical community, is that this has been a pandemic that has protected the privileged and preyed primarily upon the weaker and the less resourced, whether it's people in this country who predominantly get COVID and those who don't, or whether it's predominantly what countries are dealing with ongoing problems and low vaccination rates. And Andy Slabbitt is a former advisor to the Biden administration on pandemic response. He says that the United States has offered a lot of support to nations, for example, of the African continent. He writes, quote, "So far, the United States has sent 93 million vaccines to Africa, 13 million to Southern Africa, 8 million to South Africa alone. More is available to South Africa when they need it. The U.S. has sent 275 million free doses outside the country total and are at a clip of 3 million a day. USAID has so far provided over $250 million of support to Southern African countries to deliver and distribute vaccines, train workers, establish admin sites, and create a vaccine acceptance campaign," end quote. Todd, do you agree with Andy Slabbitt that this has been an impressive record of support?
So let me start by saying that the U.S. does have a very impressive record of delivering health services, especially in Southern Africa. The U.S. response to the HIV/AIDS crisis is something that every American should be very, very proud of. And I would say that the response to COVID very recently has been better. But South Africa is at least 6 months behind the U.S. in terms of vaccinations. The rest of the continent is even further behind, and that is in large part because of dose hoarding that was going on among the wealthier countries, including the United States. So, yes, there is a U.S. response, but it has been very, very much too slow. And I was often reminded, I thought a lot about the Ebola response back from 2014, where you may remember that the United States very proudly deployed the military and we rushed to Liberia to build emergency field hospitals. And we felt very proud about that. But actually, most of those field hospitals never saw a single Ebola patient because we got there so late. It was essentially already solved. So we do respond far too slowly to these emergencies. And that's why we're seeing, vaccination rates in Southern Africa in the single digits in many countries. South Africa's in about 20%, but way, way months behind where we are.
Yeah, and we've had some interesting conversations about the moral conundrum that many Americans may feel about booster shots, for example. So I was in that category. Initially, I was not inclined to get a booster. I didn't think the data was indicative that it was going to markedly protect me in a way that said this is a good use of this resource that could be in the hands of others. But I also can't control global supply chains and international policy. And a number of doctor friends said to me, look, if you were in charge of policy, maybe we wouldn't be boosting yet, or maybe we'd be boosting a little at a smaller clip while we distribute more vaccines more broadly. But you can't control that. And if there's a vaccine sitting on the shelf that could go bad, you ought to go get one. And that's why I got boosted. It was not an easy decision. But if it were up to me, those vaccine doses would have been concentrated where they're needed most. And one of the concerns, Charles Kenny, is that if we have a policy that is sort of insular in so many different places where that have more resources, then we are not actually protecting ourselves any better, because we are creating a scenario in which there are all kinds of opportunity for viruses to mutate. That's likely what happened with Omicron. We don't know for sure. But how do you see policy and the question of vaccine distribution, and how is that going in your eyes?
Evan, I shared your feelings of, you know, should I get a booster shot or not, and, you know, and or should I get my kids vaccinated, because, you know, frankly, they're at lower risk of serious illness than people worldwide. High risk communities worldwide that haven't got vaccinated. I think at this point we're actually somewhat beyond that discussion. In the problem we have at the moment is in the US, we have so many doses sitting around that they're being thrown away. The US threw away 15 million doses by September. Canada's so wasted about a million doses by November. We have started ramping up production, and demand is dropping in rich countries. So, you know, now should be the moment that we should really be focusing on getting these doses elsewhere, because there's increasing supply and there's not the demand here. It's become an issue of just getting the doses out the door in time. So, you know, I hope we realize as a planet how important that is, and Omicron reminds us of how important that is, because an infection anywhere is a risk everywhere. And, you know, Omicron is busy demonstrating how rapidly, we don't know where it came from, but, you know, how rapidly, new threats can spread worldwide. And we've seen the benefits if we do manage global control. The U.S. Was a really important part of the global campaign to wipe out smallpox in the 1960s and early 70s. Wiping out smallpox was, I think, probably sort of humanity's greatest single triumph, right? It killed hundreds of millions of people in the 20th century. It's killed nobody in this century. And we achieved that by wiping it out worldwide through a coordinated global effort under the World Health Organization, with big support from the U.S. and the USSR at the time, the Soviet Union, working together to make sure that we wiped it out worldwide. And as a result, not only are all of these lives saved, none of us get smallpox vaccines anymore. We save a huge amount of money each year from the fact that smallpox is eradicated. So, you know, this is a global win that we should, attempt to replicate. I don't think, you know, frankly, COVID-19 doesn't seem to be the kind of disease that we will be able to eradicate, partially because it seems to have animal reservoirs and so on. But we can turn it from this mass killer that is completely playing havoc with the global economy, throwing people back into poverty. We can turn it from that into a completely manageable, rather small cause of illness and death worldwide, but only by working together.
Talking to Charles Kenny, who is the author of the outstanding book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. It is eminently readable. You don't have to have expertise. Charles from the Center for Global Development. And Todd Moss is with us, a Rochesterian who is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Todd, that expertise is why we asked you to be on the program today. But you want to mention a little bit about some of the work you're doing now?
Before I do, I actually want to say I'm glad you mentioned Charles' book, The Plague Cycle. When I found out that Charles wrote a book about infectious disease in the middle of a pandemic, I was like, oh, good God, how could I read a book about this? It sounds depressing. But it's actually an incredibly beautiful book. It has lots of gross and occasionally funny stories, but it's really fascinating. And I know everybody's got pandemic, everybody's tired of it, but I really would encourage people to listen to. I actually did the audiobook on one of my pandemic walks, and it actually helped me get over pandemic fatigue by putting it in historical context, and I learned a lot. So I would encourage people to check out the book, even if they've had more than enough pandemic talk. Just as a former diplomat, I do worry about the other U.S. national security goals. that go beyond the pandemic from our sort of short-sighted response. If we think about our other goals besides containing the pandemic, we want to have a global economic recovery. We want jobs to come back to the U.S. We need to transition to a cleaner energy system in the United States. And, you know, one of our biggest challenges is rising to the to meet the competition that we're facing from China, Russia, and others. And really, South Africa and other regions of the world, regions of the continent that might seem far away from us are actually central to all of these goals. And we really need close allies like South Africa. And what we're doing is literally the opposite way of building these alliances. So I do worry that our shabby, shameful treatment of South Africa with this travel ban is going to have ripple effects on our national security in ways that I don't think we fully realize.
If listeners have comments and questions as we continue this conversation, you can reach the program by calling toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And our colleagues at WXXI Newsroom tell me that. And just reading from Adam Bellow's Twitter feed, he's the county executive, of course, of Monroe County. County Executive Bellow says, quote, "This morning I declared a state of emergency in Monroe County due to the rapid increase in COVID hospitalizations, which is affecting our health system's ability to treat non-COVID-related acute care and emergency cases. I am not yet calling for a countywide mask mandate, but I am instituting these changes and recommendations. Number one, a face mask requirement in all county-operated facilities for both county employees and members of the public. Number two, reinstating a work-from-home policy for Monroe County employees who are able to do so. Number three, encouraging local governments, public and private sector employers to follow suit by instituting masking requirements for their employees who work in close contact with other individuals and allow employees who can work from home to do so. And number four, expanding rapid test operations in the city of Rochester, Greece, and Pittsford. Monroe County has purchased 750,000 rapid tests for distribution to help ensure safe gatherings over the holiday season. We'll share more details soon how to access these free test kits." End quote. That's from County Executive Adam Bellow, just out. So a state of emergency does not mean he's trying to institute a mask mandate. It's an encouragement for individual organizations and employers to do it on their own, but also some hint that the talked about 750,000 rapid tests that the county ordered might finally be getting here. They wanted them here before Thanksgiving. The pipeline of supply did not allow that to happen. Their goal is to get them here very, very soon, and rapid test sites would be open. Individual families would be able to pick up rapid test home kits if you want to do that. So a lot sort of happening there as we deal with what is probably our winter sort of peak here. We know that COVID tends to go in these two-month curves where they spike over 2 months, and then we see hospitalizations and cases decline. We're not there yet. And so that's all sort of fitting into this. We have no idea how Omicron will impact this. And as much as I will want to endorse Todd's idea that Charles's book offers, I think, some comfort and some historical, fascinating perspective, there's also a section on Thomas Robert Malthus, the English scholar and cleric who wrote prolifically and rather pessimistically about the future of human beings. Malthus was writing during the late 18th century. Charles, you note that he looked ahead and saw a vicious cycle of population growth, dwindling resources, famine, and death. He also noted that pandemics had their own way of keeping the human population in check. And you quote Malthus now. I'll quote him here through your book here. This is Malthus in his own words. Quote, "The power of population is so superior to the power of the earth to produce substance for man that premature death must in some shape or other visit the human race. The vices of mankind are active and able ministers of depopulation. They are the precursors and the great army of destruction and often finish the dreadful work themselves. But should they fail in this war of extermination, sickly seasons, epidemics, pestilence, and plague advance in terrific array and sweep off their thousands and tens of thousands. Should success be still incomplete, gigantic, inevitable famine stalks in the rear and with one mighty blow levels the population with the food of the world. End quote. Woo. Malthus was, man, imagine having a beer with that guy. But why did you want to highlight this work in particular for this book? I found that fascinating, Charles.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks both for the kind words. Because the plague cycle is basically about how wrong Malthus was. You mentioned that he basically thought premature death was inevitable, that humanity, one way or another, would be seeing, you know, premature death sort of in the past, today, and all the way in the future. One of the things I mentioned in the plague cycle is what's happened to child mortality, you know, very premature death, if you will, over the last few years. Now, if you go back about 50 years, and look at their child death rates. If we had those death rates today, every second somewhere on the planet, a five-year-old would die. This second, the next second, the second after. Just an incredible death toll that meant the average parent would expect to see one of their children die before the age of five. Now, today, it's still too high. It's every 5 seconds about that the child somewhere around the world dies. But that, you know, four-fifths reduction means that we've gone from child mortality being, again, something that every parent would expect. Every parent would expect to bury a child, to that being, you know, a tragic event. And that is just such an immense boost to global quality of life. I don't know how you put a number on it, how you describe how wonderful it is. But, you know, we are making massive, massive progress against premature death worldwide. You know, COVID-19 is a horrible, disastrous, avoidable backslide. But actually, you know, in these terms, it's a blip compared to the amount of progress we've been making. It's a small reversal, one I, you know, hope we overcome very fast, but still a small reversal. And so, you know, the sort of the good news about infectious death in general, including COVID-19, is over the past two centuries, we have come up with fantastically effective policies to reduce the impact of these diseases on our lives and to reduce the number of people who die from them. I mean, you were mentioning, you know, mask mandates. Masking works. It's not completely effective at all, but it works. We've learned that, you know, social distancing works. It's expensive. It's a backstop. It's a last measure, but it works. But, you know, even better, we've come up with much better ways to deal with this disease. We have these vaccines that are still, you know, we think probably going to be fairly effective against Omicron, massively effective against earlier variants. Vaccines is what allowed us to completely destroy smallpox worldwide. Vaccines is what's made measles a rather minor cause of death worldwide from being a massive cause of death worldwide. Vaccines is why we're about to wipe out polio worldwide. You know, that we have this technology, and that now we can create this technology within, you know, a few months of discovering a new disease is just incredible progress. Testing, again, you were mentioning, you know, the testing is going to be more available. It's been horribly late coming to the United States. Mass testing was a hugely important part of why other countries managed to control COVID-19 faster. But again, you know, testing wasn't something we had 200 years ago. This is, you know, new set of medical technologies that makes our ability to respond to disease so much better. So, you know, this is a miserable moment, but it is a miserable moment in what has been 200 years of progress against infection that has, you know, completely changed the world in so many dramatic and positive ways.
Well, and there was one other part of that chapter that I found myself wondering if I was going to get an optimistic take from you, and I didn't really get it, unless I'm misreading it. You note that as agriculture advanced in society, proximity to animals meant more spread of disease. You write, quote, as humanity packed together with animals In crowded cities and villages, for example, influenza jumped from pigs or possibly ducks to infect humans, and other microbes leverage proximity to do their own spreading. For most of the time civilization has existed, pestilence has wiped out far more lives than famine and violence combined, end quote. And I guess I ignorantly found myself wondering, isn't it possible that as fewer people engage in agriculture, that as cities grow, that we live in more of an urban and less of a rural trend, as the UN tells us is happening, that this trend of viral sort of jumping from animals to humans would calm down a bit. But I don't think that's the conclusion that we should assume, especially because population continues to grow, so proximity to animals is still, I guess, relatively high. I mean, can you explain this a little bit better, Charles?
Yeah, so cities used to be sort of death traps of their own. They used to have much higher mortality than rural areas because packing people together, even if it, you know, saves you maybe from meeting a wild animal quite so often, allows you to meet a lot more other humans, and they're the usual source for, you know, catching a new disease. So they were a bit of a, not a mixed blessing at all. They were a disaster for human health for most of history. Nowadays, thanks again to, you know, all our medical advances and sanitary advances, actually people in cities tend to live longer than people in the countryside. When it comes to agriculture and rural areas, factory farming is kind of a really brilliant way to create new and rather scary diseases in that it packs a lot of animals very closely together in many places in really rather unsanitary conditions. Then we add to it by feeding them low doses of antibiotic because it turns out that helps them grow faster. But it also means that any microbes lying around, bacteria lying around being in the pigs or ducks being fed these antibiotics have a great chance to become antibiotic resistant and therefore more dangerous when they jump species. So, you know, we have a real problem when it comes to the cities we have created for our animals, if you will, the factory farms we've created for animals, and we need to deal with that. And as COVID-19 again demonstrates, you know, probably came from bats. We need to be careful about how we interact with the parts of the world that are, you know, still forested, still not farmed, because, you know, there are dangers lurking within. I think we need to be careful about. I don't want to say nobody should ever walk in a forest, but we need to think about our interaction with forested areas and think about forest preservation as one tool in both a good way to perhaps slightly slow climate change, but also a good way to reduce the risk of new pandemics. But again, you know, testing is another part of this story. We need to be monitoring and testing for new outbreaks in areas like around virgin forests, where there's a sort of higher risk of coming across a new disease.
Well, and I'd like to close this hour with both of our guests talking about where we go next and the lessons we ought to be learning. And we're going to build on what we've been talking about. And the book notes that you write, quote, "We're abusing our most effective tools against disease, misusing antibiotics by feeding them to farm animals in bulk, leaving our children unvaccinated, funding research on new bioweapons while underfunding new vaccines, treatments, and cures, and letting weak medical systems fester in the world's poorest countries," end quote. Let me start with Charles, and let's hit these one by one. First of all, you mentioned misusing antibiotics by feeding them to farm animals in bulk. Tell me a little bit more about the results and possibly concerns going forward with that, Charles.
There's a real reason you don't eat raw chicken from you buy in the supermarket. It's because it's laden with bacteria. Many of those bacteria, sadly, now are antibiotic resistant because those chickens quite often have been fed antibiotics as part of the factory farming process. We need... In the United States have been making progress in this regard. There's less use of antibiotics than there was, and much stricter rules around sanitary conditions on factory farms, but they're still not good enough. And, you know, frankly, many parts of the rest of the world, including China, are a long way behind. We need sort of international cooperation on reducing the use of this really important weapon in our fight against infection for a sort of a low marginal return of increased agricultural profits. And that has to be a central part of global cooperation going forward.
Let me turn to Todd Moss for the second one here. Leaving our children unvaccinated. When you see that on the list, Todd, I mean, are you thinking of the work that you've done around the world? I mean, is this a choice that, again, that we in the United States could largely impact with our own policy?
Well, you know, I've learned a lot of this from Charles. You know, we've made tremendous progress vaccinating children around the world. That's one of the big reasons we've seen death rates plummet. I think what Charles is probably referring to there is the tendency, the trend in the United States of rising vaccine skepticism, based on some pretty shoddy science. And how that is actually recreating new issues where we had already largely solved them. And I think at heart, it's the problem of politicians manipulating people's fears. You know, the extent to which a basic vaccination has become deeply politicized just in the last couple of years in the United States is exceedingly worrying. You know, I think if there's good news that we've discovered today in this discussion, it's that Malthus was wrong because he didn't count on human ingenuity to create lots of incredible technologies. But in what we should be worried about is the susceptibility to political manipulation of some what should really be some very basic choices. Which, you know, I think is something that's going to be very long lasting.
Well, Charles, Todd makes an interesting observation there about when we solve problems and then subsequent generations unsolve them through either misinformation or whatever it is. I mean, I've mentioned this program before, and maybe I'm waiting for somebody to write a book about sort of a prescription for how to live in peacetime. And I say that because I am sort of an adherent to the Francis Fukuyama idea that that there is a human tendency to center ourselves in some form of a struggle. And if we solve major problems and we end most wars, and nobody needs to email me to tell me we're nowhere close to that, I get it. But I'm talking about the observation that if we solved most of the major conflicts and problems and diseases and likewise and standards of living, that there would be some sort of a stirring in human beings generally to find something to struggle against, that the sort of the banal existence of peacetime doesn't work long term, and that we solved this problem, so let's unsolve it by saying vaccines were always the problem. Most of the people who say that never lived through, you know, polio and so many others and smallpox, et cetera. Does that concern you? I mean, is that tied to sort of Todd's observation about solving and unsolving problems and leaving kids unvaccinated, et cetera, Charles?
Yes, but it's a problem I'd rather have. So
fair.
It is a real problem that many parents in the United States are not getting their kids vaccinated against measles, and they're not getting themselves vaccinated against COVID-19. It's a problem that's worldwide. It's a problem that's been around since vaccines were created, by the way. Pretty much, you know, Jenner publishes his paper on how the smallpox vaccine works, and, you know, almost immediately there are people mocking the idea and saying it's going to make everybody grow udders on their arms. So, sorry, the vaccine came from cowpox, so it was going to cause people to turn into cows. This is the nature of humanity. But again, as I say, it's sort of a problem I'd rather have. And the good news for anti-vaxxers is that they're intransigence, if you will, costs them less because so many other people have got vaccines. They're much less at risk of catching the disease. So I take the point we will always need something to struggle against. I think we will always find something to struggle against. I hope it is something like, I don't know, finding a way to find life in Alpha Centauri rather than giving up on basic public health.
Let me, on that point exactly, let me get Mike in Fairport on the phone here. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I was just interested in the program quite a bit, and I saw a cartoon, an anti-vax cartoon from the Victorian era, the other day, and it showed a nurse handing a newborn to its mother, and you know, because vaca is Latin for cow, what it showed was a body of a cow and a face of a baby. And that was an anti-vax message from the Victorian era, so it's not new.
I think that's exactly an extension of what Charles was saying, right, Charles?
Absolutely, but thank you for telling the story better. the struggle got worse in the United Kingdom, at least, when they started making vaccination compulsory, and that really, you know, that led to riots in the streets, if you will. The sad fact is, for anti-vaxxers, making it compulsory worked. Pretty much the first country to wipe out smallpox within its borders was Sweden. It was pretty much the first country to make vaccination compulsory as well. You know, vaccinations work. Making everybody take vaccinations make them work better, and that is the way we really conquer infectious disease.
Another listener calls in off air just to say we have not solved climate change. Absolutely. In fact, I would just endorse the idea that if we want a collective struggle that can unite us, it ought to be climate change. It ought to be living with the standard of living that we want while innovating new ways to do that in ways that aren't nearly as damaging. And many people are moving in that direction, but I would hope that could unite us. This caller also says we haven't solved nuclear war either. We haven't, although it's a bit of a remarkable thing that we haven't seen since Nagasaki, another attack with a similar weapon, given the fact those weapons exist and that there are nefarious actors who would probably like to use them. And Charles writes that we fund research on new bioweapons while underfunding new vaccines, treatments, and cures. So we haven't solved nuclear war or war in general. But, Charles, are you an optimist or a pessimist on sort of, because and the other sort of dark cloud in my mind is the world changes forever the first time a nuclear weapon goes off in a major population center anywhere in the world. The world, that's the end of history, to borrow Fukuyama's term, and the start of a new one, and it's not going to be pretty. And I hope we never live in that world, but I think of that often. I'm curious to know where you are on that, Charles.
I agree. I think few events could you imagine that would change the world more. You mentioned bioweapons, though. Nuclear weapons, at least, we have a pretty robust international system designed to stop their spread, you know, find out where they are, control who has access to the you know, underlying resources you need to make them and so on. Compare the bioweapons convention. Now, it's not too hard to genetically manipulate infectious diseases to make them mass killers. I don't think that happened with COVID-19. Others do, and it's plausible because it's not that hard. The Bioweapons Convention has sort of three or four full-time staff worldwide working to see whether people are living up to the convention's rules, which aren't very strong. So I think, you know, if I'm worried about nuclear weapons, I'm even more worried about the threat of bioweapons. And I think the world as a whole needs to take the wake-up call of COVID-19, not just to think about how do we better respond to sort of natural infectious risks, but how do we make sure nobody creates and uses an artificial infectious risk.
Okay. Todd, where are you on that issue?
Yeah. Well, Evan, I'm glad that your caller mentioned climate change, because you know, one of the things that came out of the big climate conference in Glasgow that just finished, a couple of days ago, is that South Africa, ironically, was at the heart of the discussions, because South Africa is still a very heavily coal-dependent economy. In fact, 87% of their electricity comes from coal, and hundreds of thousands of jobs are in coal. And the U.S., along with the Europeans, put intense pressure on the South Africans to move away from coal. So imagine that you are the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa. Your country's reeling from the pandemic. Your unemployment is over 30%, right? In the U.S., it's 4.5%. It's over 30% in South Africa. He's under massive pressure to turn off his coal plants and shut the coal mines. Because why should he do that? Because the Europeans and the Americans are telling him, we're all in this climate crisis together. We all have to do our part. And he's now come home, and now he's being in his country is facing a travel ban. That doesn't seem like we're all in this together. And I am fairly confident that this episode is going to have an impact on South Africa's climate commitments going forward. So again, this is how shoddy treatment and short-sightedness by the United States in one area can have some pretty dangerous spillover in other areas. Mm,
well said. And Todd, 30 seconds from you. What do you want to see next from world leaders as we deal with Omicron?
Well, I would like to see very open information sharing. It's clear that more variants are coming, and what happens with the next one, you know, what happens with the next one, which could be more deadly than Delta or Omicron, is going to depend on how much we're able to cooperate. So I hope we learn the lessons from this episode.
And cheers to South Africa for sharing, despite the fact that they are the recipient of some of these travel bans. I hope that doesn't discourage future sharing. Charles, what do you want to see?
Vaccine equity and economic support to help developing countries respond from the immense social costs of this epidemic.
Do you think we're going to get that?
No.
I'm laughing at the bluntness.
Sorry.
We
do better than we are, but I don't think we'll get enough.
Well, I mean, we've talked about how politicization has impacted policy, and think about future campaigns where one party says, can you believe that the other guy sent our vaccines around the world when we still had people dying here? It's going to happen. I hate to see it, but it's going to happen. Charles Kenny's book is called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Congratulations on an important book, and I hope a lot of people pick it up and learn from it. Thank you, Charles, for being with us.
Thanks.
Todd Moss, former Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. Timely, great perspective as always, Todd. Thanks for being with us again.
Always great to be with you, Evan.
All right, more connections coming up in just a moment.